They're like, get the fuck out of here. They're shoving me. They're calling me a baby killer. I turn around. There are like 20 cameras on me, like iPhones. There are actually like news cameras going off in my face.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am. Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
With Shai Davidai.
This season of Here I Am with Shai Davidai is dedicated to the memory of my grandmother, Savta Leah Davidai, who passed away earlier this year. Here I am with Savta Leah in mind.
My guest today is a journalist at the Free Press. She holds a master's from Columbia Graduate School of Journalism.
Boo! Just joking.
And she has written some of, I believe, the most insightful and important articles of the past 20 months to understand what's going on in the U.S. So here I am, with Olivia Rheingold.
Here I am. Wow. Thank you so much. What an honor.
Thank you for coming.
I can't believe I'm worthy of that compliment. I'll let others decide that, but
of course
thank you.
Are.
That's and, very kind.
And you mentioned that you used to produce podcasts,
yeah.
But you don't often are the guest.
No. Yeah, this is actually my first writing job. I used to be a podcast producer and a radio reporter, and I was extremely into it, where I was like making audio and podcast art like for fun. Wow. But I'm very relieved to be out of it. But excited. I mean, being a podcast guest, like what is more fun than that? Producing it? Sorry to the producers. I don't know about that, but being a guest is very fun.
All right. So let's jump into the fun. And one thing that I like is you showed up and you were already like, clearly you've done your homework. You've watched episodes or listened to episodes. So you know the first question that's going to come
up. I'm nervous.
Up.
I think I do.
Olivia Rheingold, what kind of a Jew are you?
I like a self-questioning one, like a self-doubting one.
Okay.
I guess I would say secular, like a Jew. I'm trying to figure out what kind of Jew I am. I think that's what kind of Jew I am.
What are you doing to figure that out?
A smidge of temple, conversations with my family, like I... you know, post October 7th, I guess I've been on a journey. I mean, let's just get into it. I guess I had some big questions for my dad about intermarriage and about his relationship to Judaism. I feel a lot
You're a patrilineal.
Yes. Jew. Yes. And I feel a lot of, guilt and shame about breaking the link, and I don't want it to be broken. And yet it's going to take an immense amount of effort to like undo how much I've kind of been coasting on learning about the faith and the traditions. Like growing up, we celebrated a few, you know, I went to temple like a few times a year, basically. We would do like Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, and Passover. And that was really it. Anyways, sorry, that's like a really, there's a lot of baggage there.
No, that's not, I mean, I think what you're expressing is what a lot of people feel. Not necessarily guilt and shame, but rather, you know, you want to keep the heritage going. You want to keep the links going.
And yeah.
Not everyone knows how or what their link is.
I think about my ancestors a lot, which feels weird to say, but like what they would think if they ever imagined that by coming to America, that in a few generations, like, you know, their future relatives would be unrecognizable to them, not just because things change and we wear different clothes, but like our values, and that they would, by seeking refuge here, it would be their undoing in a way.
Right. And in a way, that's the story of the Jews as a persecuted
right.
people.
Right.
When we get very comfortable, mm-hmm. we start losing the connection
yes.
to what made us uncomfortable in the first place, but then something like October 7th happens and reminds us of our uncomfort.
Yeah.
So not everyone still, which is weird to me, but not everyone yet knows what the Free Press is.
Oh, okay.
In a sentence or two, what is the Free Press?
We are all either mainstream media rejects, or I guess I would say dissidents, who left places like the New York Times, NPR, Politico, to start something radically curious and fair.
What does that mean? So clearly a lot of people believe there's an issue with the mainstream media. Often the retort is, of course, everyone thinks the media is biased against them.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Why is the Free Press different?
Right.
Or how?
Whoa. Okay, well, I guess I would say that we will report on things that no one wants to touch. Like, I mean, a controversial example, but a really widely read story of ours that actually ended up making, you know, becoming the subject of, or being used in congressional inquiries was, we've had various whistleblower accounts from people working at gender clinics, just basically saying out of concern for the kids there that patients were not properly vetted. Anyway, so that is a story that later was confirmed by the New York Times. I think what maybe started out as an attempted expose of our reporting, actually they confirmed our reporting. And that is a story, though, that we were very early to, and that I guess I would say our sweet spot is like kind of being early to those changes and reporting on what others are not, like announcing what is obvious to everyone, but they're not yet willing to say. And yeah, I mean, of course, there are certainly critics who say that we have just developed our own form of bias. But I think if you read us closely, we will often publish things that are in contention.
But you mentioned that you're a group of rejects, refugees, and dissidents from places like New York Times, NPR, Politico, which are quite left-leaning media outlets.
Sure, yeah.
So isn't the Free Press just a right-leaning media outlet?
No, I don't think so. I think we're I don't really think that there is, I think the connecting thread is being countercultural, is questioning the conventional wisdom. And so that can move depending on who's in office, what is going on. But if you read us closely, we've been quite critical of Trump. We published an op-ed. I'm just remembering the headline, but it was standing up for the free speech rights of people like Mahmoud Khalil and some of these anti-Israel activists. Mm-hmm. And so we publish things that sometimes we personally disagree with. I would say we do that often. And I have been assigned things that like I don't always agree with too. Yeah.
Interesting. So I really want to delve into your articles. I was kind of organizing all my thoughts for this interview. And I feel like, first of all, I don't know who, if it's you or your editors or who gives the titles to your articles, but they are great.
The Columbia one was mine.
And they really give a story. They tell a story that connects the dots.
Thank you.
So I just want to start and we'll see where the story goes. Let's start with, I went to cover a protest. I was surrounded by a mob.
Yeah.
What happened?
Okay.
What was this protest?
That was a pivotal moment for me. So that was after, I think that anti-Israel activists call it, I don't know how you say it, the Nusrat. It's a refugee camp within Gaza. They consider what happened a massacre. Well, from the Israeli perspective, this was about a year ago. So May 2024. From the Israeli perspective, it was a hostage rescue operation in which I think Noah Argamani was rescued, right. But civilians were killed. I know that that's passive voice, and now I'm honestly I can't remember how they died, but.
Well, what happened was, just to remind people, so four hostages that were held in civilian apartments.
Right, right.
Or quote-unquote civilian apartment, including Noah Argamani, Andrei Kozolov, and Almog John Meir, and blanking out on the fourth one, were rescued. One of the vehicles was shot at and basically was stationary. They couldn't move. Mm. And at that point, you know, civilians started running at the IDF soldiers, which started shooting around. A lot of people were killed. I agree. That's a passive voice.
Yeah.
That was what happened.
I just got tongue-tied. But basically, like, the idea here is that this group within our lifetime, which is extremely radical, they were holding a protest calling this a massacre, you know. From the Israeli perspective, this is a huge success that, of course, came with upsetting civilian deaths, but they were Israeli hostages. But anyway, people in New York City decided to organize a protest against this hostage rescue operation. And I went to cover it because I'm addicted to covering these things. When they have a rally, like, I've got to go see what's happening. What are the new chants? What are people up to? And I went, and it was going fine. And then, like, an hour in, this guy, he's wearing a Hezbollah headscarf. He's holding a flag that says "Long Live October 7th." And he spots me and he goes, "She's a Zionist, because I had a Free Press bag on." And
how did he personally recognize you?
I don't think so. I think he saw the Free Press logo and he is familiar. Like, yeah, I've done a lot of reporting on the extreme anti-Israel movement. We certainly have been critical of Hamas sympathizers. So perhaps that was his issue. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of keep, like, honestly, I was kind of tired. Like, I just kind of keep moseying. I think people will ignore him. Like, there's a lot of commotion anyway. There are chants going on. But pretty quickly, people swarm me. People are, like, tripping over themselves to surround me. And they're kind of, like, jostling me. They're yelling at me. I am allowed to curse, right?
You can do whatever you want.
Okay. They're like, "Get the fuck out of here." And they're shoving me. They're calling me a baby killer. I turn around. There are like 20 cameras on me, like iPhones. There are actually like news cameras going off in my face. And,
other reporters are seeing this.
I don't know. Like, I think that they might be activists who are documenting. Yeah, I guess. But it's like actual cameras. Like, that's just what I meant. And at first, my instinct is to just keep writing down what they're saying, like to try and report. So I'm like, I want to talk. Like, tell me. Like, I'm trying to interview these people as they're accosting me.
So they're surrounding you. Are they telling you anything? Are they engaging in the conversation?
It's literally like chaos. Like, it's like yelling. And I'm obviously, my first instinct is like, I'm kind of an easy crier. Like, I kind of want to cry. But I'm like, because I'm in instant fight or flight mode. People are shoving me. But I just keep writing down. The whole crowd starts chanting, "Olivia, go to hell." Normally that chant is, "Israel, go to hell." But they read my name on my press badge and they start chanting, "Olivia, go to hell." And so I'm just writing down. I'm going, "Olivia, go to hell." Like, I'm taking notes because I'm trying to do my job. And a girl rips the notebook out of my hands and is like, "You're not fucking, like, writing down anything." And she like tears it up and they stomp on all of my notes. There were like notes that I needed in there. And they start kind of shoving me and an air horn is
why? Why are they trying to block you from reporting? Isn't the whole point of a protest to expose, right, to get exposure, to let the world know what within our lifetime is doing in New York City?
It was just mass. Like, in some ways, there was no thought to it, but it was not to say it was thoughtless, because it was completely sincere. Like, they hated me. They hated me. It was a public place. It was in Union Square. And so I told them, I'm not leaving. You can't kick me out of a public square. And so they put keffiyehs around me, and, you know, they tried to shove me out. They kept stepping closer and closer to me. And even if literally, like, our bodies were touching, like, I just wasn't going to move. They put an air horn. Like, I lost hearing in one of my ears for a few days because they had an air horn going off. I can't remember which ear it was, but going off right in my ear. And as a writer, I like to keep earplugs in my pocket. And so I had earplugs there, but I remember being terrified, like, to show weakness, like, because I didn't want to leave. And if as I was taking them out, I was worried they were going to, like, flick them away, and then I would have to leave. Sorry, I don't know what your question was, but why were they doing that? I don't know. Because there's a lot of hatred at those rallies. There's a lot of hatred, and it's looking for a target. And normally they're chanting about Israel, but that is kind of, or Zionists, but that's kind of an esoteric, that's quite far away. And so it's really thrilling and exciting when an object of your hatred turns up right in front of you.
Were there any other journalists around?
I don't know. There were a lot of police around, though. There were a lot of police. And afterwards, I remember going up to an officer. I did file a police report. Obviously, they did nothing. But, like, they were pushing me. They destroyed my property.
Why do you say, obviously, they did nothing?
I mean, honestly, just because that's the way people made me feel about it. That's the way people, like, online, you know, I think there were people in my life that made me feel like I was being dramatic, but, it definitely occurred to me at one point that, like, someone could pull out a knife. But I don't know what's wrong with me. I was like, I need to stay here, though.
But even beyond the immediate threat, we have a journalist trying to report on a public event in a public park in New York City while police officers are,
right,
present, looking and doing,
right,
nothing.
Right.
Then files a report. Nothing is done. That's,
right,
and you know what? Freedom of speech.
I don't know if you know what they did later that night, but that was the night. If you've seen the video. So on their next location that they went to was to protest outside of the exhibit for the Nova Music Festival, in which there were survivors of October 7th inside of that. And they consider that genocidal propaganda. And so they were protesting that. And on their way there, that there was that viral clip of that guy yelling in a subway car, if there are any Zionists, like, you need to get the hell out or something. So it was, yeah. And I think that if perhaps police had intervened earlier, like, I think there's a real cost to not intervening. And the whole night just escalated and escalated.
Why do you think they didn't intervene? As someone who has been to many of these protests.
Yeah, it's interesting. To be honest, afterwards, after it happened, sorry, I'm laughing because when there was one woman there who was probably, like, pro two-state solution. She was, I think, like, 85 years old, and she was, like, so confused. I think she showed up to advocate for peace, and she was, like, so confused by what was happening. And she was the only one who was kind of, like, showed any concern or any disagreement with how I was treated. And afterwards, after it all ended, like after 45 minutes, they dispersed, you know, and she stayed back. And I can't remember. I think we like held hands and I was like, I couldn't even look at her. I was like shaking because I had been in fight or flight mode for so long at that point. And anyway,
I think what you just described, an older woman confused because about what's going on, because she wanted to advocate for peace.
Yeah, she thought this was a peace rally.
I think that's what most of Americans, when their only exposition to these protests are, you know, what they read in the New York Times, what they hear in NPR, is they think these are anti-war, pro-peace rallies. They don't know that within our lifetime, openly supports Hamas, Hezbollah, ISIS.
More than that, they support terrorist activity in the U.S. So recently when there was the attack in Boulder, one of the leaders of Within Our Lifetime said something like, you know, if you're really anti-imperialist, like you have to be, this is what it means. Like, you know, if you oppose genocide, like this is what it means. You have to
throwing
resistance.
Molotov
this
cocktails,
is resistance. Yeah.
Molotov cocktails and Holocaust survivors.
At a mall.
At a public mall in Boulder, Colorado is the protest for
it's so
people
crazy.
Like Nurdin Kiswani
like,
within our life.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've covered other protests in the past that are unrelated to this specific issue. Has anything
they
similar?
Are all the same vibe. They are all like they're all tinder boxes. The first one I went to was on October 8th, 2023, in New York City. And they haven't. I think what's interesting to me is that when they first started happening, I think that there were more kind of clueless white people who were showing up. And what's surprising to me is the longer they've gone on, the more, like occasionally I think I would talk to someone who they believed Israel has a right to exist or they had more moderate views. But now the average participant who I speak with that is in this movement, like has a completely radical anti-Israel worldview.
So you've seen the radicalization happening in real time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it already started radical because October 8th.
Yeah.
2023, while the massacre was still going on, there was a protest. You were there. What was that protest about? What were they protesting?
So the
clearly
difference,
not Hamas.
The difference, no, it was a celebration. It was a celebration. Like it was, they were pulling up there. It was out when I went to it. It started out in Times Square. By the time I got there, it was outside of the Israeli consulate in Midtown. And there were supporters of Israel across the street. And it was celebratory, really. It was showing images from October 7th and taunting the supporters of Israel. And I guess what was different, though, is that those were young, either children of immigrants or they were foreign themselves. Like it was people who understood, okay, this is a religious war. Like they understood this is not about Zionism. This is not about oppressed people. Like these are Jews and we killed Jews. And they were, it was people who understood what was going on. There were not clueless white liberals wandering up to it being like, I'm against colonization. There was none of that. It was much more chants in Arabic and things like that. But then already by that Monday, I went to another rally and like I met some I met like computer software engineers from Brooklyn and like ACLU interns, and it was already a different vibe where it was growing.
Monday, October 9th, yeah. 2023.
Yeah.
So let's delve into what these protests are, which, you know, going to the next article with honestly the clearest title that I've read in a long time, how Hamas infiltrated Europe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is the story there? What did you cover?
That was about new research that had come out uncovering this web of, you know, various financiers who were actively fundraising for Hamas or Hamas-linked entities in Europe. And it's very hard and very confusing to figure out these direct links, but this there was research showing that these various fundraisers had been photoed with photographed with leaders of Hamas, and it was just about exposing that network.
So how do we get to a point where, you know, we got activists in Europe fundraising for Hamas?
I have no idea. And a big question I have, I think the answer is yes, but like, is that happening here? And it's very hard to tell like where your money goes when you are donating it to charities and to help the people of Gaza. It's very hard to know like how it's being used. But I don't know if this is another story you're planning to talk about, but I went to this conference
the very next title is we go from how Hamas infiltrated Europe to how to make your campus Palestinian.
Right. Yeah. So that was, I went undercover at this conference outside of Chicago hosted by American Muslims for Palestine, which some of the leaders of that group have previously been linked or accused of fundraising for Hamas. And this is basically, there's been this lawsuit that has been going on for like 3 decades from this family whose son was one of the first victims of Hamas, I think in the
1996.
Yeah,
David,
you know,
Boehm.
Exactly. Yeah. This is one of this is the group that they believe that after this family sued, some sort of nonprofit that was operating in the U.S. because they argued they were fundraising for Hamas, that group dispersed, and American Muslims for Palestine is one of the groups that was created out of that.
And it was created by Hatem Bazian, who's the creator
my
of
pal.
Students for Justice
mm-hmm.
in Palestine.
Yeah, one of my closest friends. No, I'm just joking. He actually really hates me. I don't know if you've seen the video of him. I was talking to him outside of the DNC last summer, and there was this brave, you know, courageous Jewish kid walking through, like holding a pro-Israel sign. And I was interviewing that guy, and he yelled at the Jewish kid, and
Hatem Bazian yelled at the Jewish kid.
Yeah.
Hatem Bazian is a professor at Berkeley.
Oh my gosh. Wait, I am confused. Hatem. Oh. I'm thinking of someone else's first name who is Hatem.
I see. Sorry.
Yeah. No. Sorry. But this is a guy, a Chicago. It's okay. Sorry. We got, our wires right. crossed there. I've been accosted many times if you couldn't tell.
Really? So, okay. So
the conference.
It was called the Annual Convention for Palestine?
Palestine Convention, something like that.
What is this conference?
I don't know why they have it. I guess it's I mean, I guess it's why you would have a pro-Israel conference. It's just to come together and, but it's in theory to talk about, well, there were a lot of sessions on the state of the genocide, mm-hmm. in their words. And I think it's just to kind of galvanize different activists from all over the country towards the anti-Israel cause. And so there was this room that was sequestered, which was for college students. I am wearing a hijab at this because like 80% of the women or so were wearing one. And honestly, a lot of those activists, I feel like they know who I am. I don't want to be recognized. And I also just, I actually did think it was culturally like a sign of respect. But anyway, there was this room that was for college students. And I was like, I know I have to go in there. I was so scared to go in there because there's nothing scarier than an anti-Israel college activist.
Really?
Yeah.
So you just told me that you were accosted by a mob of within our lifetime protesters, which I see within our lifetime as a domestic terror organization. And yet you were afraid to go undercover to a room full of college students.
Because I think that they're really, the college students in that room, if you were to pull them on what they stand for, I don't think it's that different than what the average within our lifetime organizer believes, you know? It's like, I mean, that group of college students that was there that day, they might be like, resistance is a little more complicated. Like they might be a little more less full-throated endorsement of violence, but ultimately you kind of end up in the same place. So yeah, I was scared to walk in, but I go in there and I can't remember what they were talking about that day, but it's all about, they were holding a practice session on like, what would you do if an Israeli government official is supposed to speak on your college campus? Like, how can you organize against that? They had some sort of simulation where it was a challenge where we were in different teams and I was with like a bunch of these college students and we were going, oh, what could we say? Like, the only thing I can remember at this point is saying, we really need to get Jewish kids involved. Cause like, if we have the Jews, then it will be a lot harder to say we're doing anything wrong. Like let's call up JVP, let's get JVP involved. Mm-hmm.
Jewish Voice for Peace.
Yes. Yes.
So tell me, like, what's the average attendant in this room?
College room?
Yeah.
They were from regional schools in the area. I think a lot of people were from outside of Milwaukee. My understanding is they're kids of immigrants throughout the Middle East, but I think that these were kids who are born in the U.S., obviously U.S. citizens, and studying at American universities.
And what was the goal? Like, why are we holding this session? I mean, the article is called "How to Make Your Campus Palestinian."
That's right. I think that was the name of one of the sessions.
So this is their name. This is what they mean. What does that mean to make a campus Palestinian? Like, I am Israeli. I support Israel, but I have no goal of making campus or anything in the U.S. Israeli. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. I guess it's really just how to spread the craze, like how to get everyone whipped up into a frenzy over this, how to turn this into a big enough deal that your administration succumbs to it.
And you've been following the campus protests for a while. Another article that you wrote was camping out at Colombia's communist Coachella.
Yeah.
So break down that title, you know, because this, you're basically describing the the illegal encampment
that
took place at Columbia,
right,
ended with the violent taking over of Hamilton Hall.
Right. Right.
What did you see? What is this communist Coachella?
Okay.
Because it sounds, I have to say, like, my first reaction when I saw the title was a little bit, oh, it's making light of this.
It's honestly both. It's honestly both, because the vibe is very like, oh my gosh, let's make friendship bracelets. Should it be like queer fags for Palestine? Like, it's very, sorry, that's offensive to me. Like, it's, but that was the kind of language where it's extremely far left, kind of like kids who haven't been socialized, weren't socialized during the pandemic. And this is so fun. They get to get together and be like, oh my gosh, someone was gossiping about you there. I remember that. They were gossiping about you. And they were saying, oh my gosh, so-and-so is totally a Zionist. But it's very eerie where it feels like a police state in there, where if you say the wrong thing, it's kind of like, everyone is really careful about language, about, bowing down to the sovereignty of Palestinians. Like, there's a total hierarchy where if there was a person of color, like, we need to ask them what they think of this. So it was a really, there were strong authoritarian vibes, but at the same time, there was like a 17-step nut protocol to like protect people from who have like nut allergies. Mm-hmm. Like, it was extremely soft in there, but also really scary. It was kind of both.
So I'm really interested in, partially why I'm so interested in that is because, you know, famously, when I tried to go into this quote unquote liberated zone, I got locked out of campus, not by the protesters, but by the administration, who wouldn't even let me get close.
I'm kind of remembering that.
And you're saying there was very, you know, meticulous concern about language.
Yeah.
That's not the first thing that I think about when I think about the mob of students at Columbia shouting death to the Zionist state or kill Zionists or Zionists do not deserve to live or, you know, we don't want two states, we want all of it. What language are they careful about? Because it doesn't seem like they're too careful.
I mean, I think that is, I can't think of an example, but it's this entire, I don't really know how to explain it other than anytime any topic of like gender, race, and even the topic, there was no, see, to me, when you're giving the example of those chants, I'm like, I still see the connection because there's no room for someone to say, guys, what if we say, like, not death to the Zionist state, but like, let's reform the Zionist state. Like, there's no appetite for discussion. It's just submission to the status quo. And so to me, it actually is, it all runs together. It was not a place where dissent was tolerated. In fact, to enter, you had to agree to something like 18 rules. It also was not easy for me to get in there. Like, they knew I worked for the Free Press. And there was this kid who was bravely holding an Israeli flag in there. And at first, I kind of pretended like I was going to go in and just talk to him. And they you know, tried to, like, they told me I couldn't go and I just walked past them. Like, you know, the guards they had in the orange vest.
Some of them were faculty in the orange vest guarding in the encampment.
Yeah.
And again, this is a public space at the university. This
absolutely.
Wasn't a, you know, they ironically called it liberated zone. But it was liberated.
They literally had walls, and it was fenced. It was fenced off. And the craziest thing to me is that they actually help. I feel like they, by having fences and by having so many rules about for our safety, we need only these kinds of people to enter. Like, they actually seem really in touch with the Israeli argument for, like, they were trying to protect themselves from people like me, which I understand, but they run a really tight ship. About, like, they, you know, arguably, like, if they were running Israel, like, they would put up a border wall like that, you know? So I feel like they defy their own arguments.
Right. It's that's interesting, right? They occupy the space yeah. by force yeah, to argue against occupation. But you know, I have some friends who mentioned that their friend's daughter was in an encampment, mm-hmm. Was protesting at yeah. her university, and they portrayed that student, that girl, which I don't know her, as peace loving, mm-hmm. you know, right. anti-war,
right?
Clearly. And I don't know each right. and every one of the protesters what right. they think, but clearly the movement at Columbia, at Cornell, NYU, at all these universities, two states is like off the table. Like
yeah.
they refuse to have no. any inch of existence no. for Israel as a yeah. state. Don't the students, the protesters in that encampment, do they get it? Do they understand what they are
no.
supporting?
No, they do not understand. They think that there is a huge distinction between Zionism and Judaism. They don't understand. And in fact,
but they must have heard the arguments that
I'm not sure.
The
I'm
vast
not sure.
majority of Jews are Zionists. That Zionism is just a belief that Jews have a right for self-determination.
I think those they have probably heard. I do not think that most understand like how the land was partitioned. But at the same time, I think most participants do believe that Jews are white colonizers, that they literally are from Europe. But yeah, I think that there's a lack of curiosity just about the basic history. I think they think they are informed, but there's a real lack of scrutiny. And I think part of that is because, like, it's kind of fun. It reminded me why I wrote it like that is because it kind of reminded me of like being at summer camp and it kind of sucks where you're like, gosh, like this place sucks. And then, but then you make friendships over it and you're like, you're kind of, it's like a negative energy that binds you together. There is something about having a common enemy that is bonding. And so that's why I wrote it like that. But yeah, your friend's daughter, I don't know. I think there were people in there because it was a social atmosphere. I think there were people in there who really like were more clueless. I think there were some passersby who, but the people who were sleeping in the tents, the people who were like living out there and were willing to risk expulsion and stuff like that, of those are people who believe we can't judge how someone else resists. Like if you were literally like in Auschwitz, like wouldn't you rise up against your slave master? I think that's how those they think of it in an extremely binary way.
I don't think I would ever, for any reason, under any duress, rape anyone. So yeah. what's their views of?
Well, they don't think that happened. I think they don't. That's my guess. The activists that I have, I didn't speak to any of those Columbia activists about that. I don't think, but the activists I have spoken to about this topic, they don't believe it happened, and that is actually a very common belief, like among Brooklyn progressives.
That October 7th didn't happen.
A lot of it was like, it's so shocking. I just, but a lot that Israel actually killed a lot of, like, Israel is responsible for a lot of the death that day.
It's that belief that it didn't happen. If it happened, it wasn't us.
Yeah.
And if it was us, it was justified.
Right. Right. Right.
There's an underlying to all of that of real violence.
Yeah.
You know, you use
really
terms
scary.
Like authoritarian, totalitarian, exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And yet many in the media have described these protests, these encampments as, you know, pro-peace, peaceful protests, pro-Palestinian, anti-genocide. What would you say is the right way, in your view, to describe these protests and these encampments?
Anti-Israel. I'm not saying, like, of course there are people who are pro-Palestine. I still believe that that's possible, despite what I have seen through my reporting. But the marches in New York City, it's anti-Israel, because it's a mode of attack. It's all opposition. It's all hostility to Israel. It's not like Palestinian solidarity, like celebrating Palestinian resistance in like a nonviolent way, like mm-hmm. not like Palestinian resilience or anything. It's like, anyway, so yeah, I would say anti-Israel.
So the interesting thing for me, and this is where we get to another article that you wrote, is that a lot of this protest movement, which, you know, the focus is anti-Israel, pro-Hamas, you know, like you said, Hezbollah headbands,
mm-hmm.
Long live October 7th, like
right.
really, really horrific
yes.
violence, is that the violence doesn't stop there. And you wrote this article, almost like an expose, called Inside the Cult of Luigi Mangiani.
Oh, yeah.
And there's, so who is Luigi Mangiani and what's this cult? Because I see a very big overlap between
yeah,
that cult
totally,
and
totally.
The pro-Hamas cult.
Absolutely. So Luigi Mangione, he was allegedly, there will be a trial that will take place this summer, but he is accused of murdering the CEO of United Healthcare on the streets of Manhattan. He was an Ivy League graduate, and a lot of people see him as a folk hero, see him as someone who corrected a grave injustice of, you know, constant healthcare claim denials and these companies that are really, I think they think that United Healthcare is in the business of killing, like deciding who gets to live and who gets to die. And so Luigi Mangione, they view as a hero.
Who are these people?
A
young person who prints a 3D gun and murders a father of two in the streets of New York in broad daylight. Who are these people that see this kind of guy as a hero?
They're literally like a cute 37-year-old customer service associate in like Missouri. who they are.
How do they explain that?
I think, you know, usually there's something, some of them have gone through a really frustrating like healthcare denial or, you know, a coverage claim denial but usually it just boils down to like extreme class resentment and extreme frustration over income inequality and a sense of injustice where they feel very frustrated with the state of America and feel like there are people getting rich off of making people like them fat, sick, and sometimes dead.
But Luigi Mangiani is not lower class, not right, working class, right, not middle class, not upper middle class. He went to UPenn.
Right.
I had a conversation recently with someone who lives in my neighborhood who owns a $6 million townhouse and said that Luigi Mangiani is not only a hero, but that we need more like him because there are more CEOs that need to be killed.
It's getting so scary. Yeah.
Where is this violent streak in political action coming from?
I mean, that is a really deep question. It also relates to some of what's happening with the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA. Yeah. I mean, it really is all connected.
Because your next article was the Democratic Socialists of America don't know if they should condemn murder.
Right. Which that was related to the murders outside of the Capitol Jewish Museum in D.C., where, two Israeli embassy staffers were killed, one of whom was Jewish, but they both, had ties and allegiance to Israel. And I think it's safe to say the intent was to kill Jews. And the DSA, which is a group that if you live in certain parts of Brooklyn, it's really cool to say you believe in, actually, this guy, Zohran Mamdani, who I feel like could totally become our next mayor of New York City.
That's your next article. The young socialist wants to run New York City.
Yeah, he is a member of the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, as is AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so you might think that this group is fringe, but there's a lot of momentum behind it. Their numbers have they've grown so much since 2016 because Bernie, in a way, gave the movement a lift. And
Bernie
anyway, that story that I wrote about the DSA was I think it was the New York City chapter was divided over whether to condemn those murders.
You yourself entered
chat? Their chat room.
What happens in a chat where people, this is a large, legitimate organization,
yeah,
even if you don't like their ideas, but
right,
a legitimate organization in the United States arguing about whether murder should be condemned, and not only murder, like a hate crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are the different views? Give you the argument why it should be condemned. I can't imagine what is the argument against that.
I think there were two schools of thought. One is it's the same, it's, a common thread here where it's like, we can't yuck someone's yum. Like that could be resistance to someone. And also there's a discussion, isn't that what resistance means? Like if we really want, aren't they committing a genocide? So these people work for Israel. Like, don't we have to do something about this? I think that is one school of thought. And then the other, actually, I feel like that's really that those were the pro, at least let's not condemn. Those were the people who didn't want to condemn the murders. And then there were people who were like, wait, what? and I think kind of like that peace activist who's 85 years old and showed up to the march. I think there were people who were more Gen X or maybe even boomers in the chat who were really shocked, who felt like, this is not the movement I signed up for.
So I know we kind of zoomed over all of these things because really there's a lot going on and there is a thread. So I just want to really connect the dots again. We start with a story where you go to a protest of Within Our Lifetime and you get really swarmed by the mob,
mm-hmm,
who refuses to let a journalist do her job in a public space because they disagree with you.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you to cover. So it's a clearly totalitarian. We talk about Hamas infiltrating activist groups, fundraising for mm-hmm Hamas through these sham charities where well-meaning Europeans, well-meaning white
right,
Americans
right,
giving money, don't know where it's going, but it ends up going Hamas, then instructions of how to make your campus, you know, inhospitable for Israelis and many Jews, the communists Coachella of the encampments, the policing of thought and conversation, the love or support to or folk heroism of a murderer, cold-blooded murderer, the conversation in the democratic socialists of America of should we or shouldn't we condemn, you know, a hate crime murder, and all of that brings us to, you know, as of the time we're recording this, the day before the election to the primary in New York City, where Zohan Mamdani could be the next mayor of New York City.
Yeah.
How does he fit into all of that?
So Zohran Mamdani became interested in politics as a college student at Bowdoin, which is a very elite private college in Maine. And
very expensive.
Very expensive. I think after you price out the cost of living, it's currently around $100,000 a year to attend. But while he was there as a student, probably about maybe more than a decade ago, something like that, he founded his college's chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, and has said that that's really how he became interested in politics. And so he gets his start as, I don't know what he was thinking then. Maybe he really did start out as kind of like a pro-Palestine activist. But, you know, fast forward to today, recently there was a mayoral forum at a synagogue where he was asked about BDS, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction movement. And he said that he believes the city has an obligation to uphold international law, which to him, it seemed like an implication that, well, according to international law, I need to sanction and divest the city from Israel. So he has also said that that he would jail Netanyahu were he to step foot in the city. And so in many ways, the mayoral race has become a proxy war for Israel and Palestine.
And not only is he, you know, founded his Students for Justice in Palestine, which, by the way, was founded by the head of American Muslims for Palestine.
That's right.
You attended. And not only is his father, Mahmoud Mamdani, a professor of Middle Eastern studies at Columbia University, and one of these professors who's brainwashed the protesters that you talked with, but he's also affiliated and marched with Within Our Lifetime.
Right. That was stuff, I don't mean to brag, that was original reporting that I feel like not enough people really pick up on, but that I was able to kind of coordinate, like figure out where he had been on certain days and go back in time and then figure out, you know, where and when these Within Our Lifetime rallies were happening and piece together that he had been to at least two. I think the number is probably more like four, but there could be more that I don't even know about. And you might say that post October 7th Within Our Lifetime has become more radical. And I think that's true, but it was already extremely radical. Like he was showing up to events, one of the rallies. I can't remember what the language was, but I remember thinking, wow, there was that on a poster and like he showed up to that. It was pretty intense language.
How does someone like that become the second runner, you know, after
and
Andrew Cuomo?
As a progressive, right? Like that's a big question, is how does someone with that track record, it's not actually working against him, it's actually seen as evidence of his progressivism.
So in a way, it feels like even if he doesn't win the mayoral election, we've lost.
I mean, he's a star. Like if he doesn't win the mayoral election, like he's formidable, to be honest. And he has a real knack for going viral. I think he, and you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, I think that Andrew Cuomo, the former governor of New York, who is now polling beneath Mamdani. So Zoe Rahn is polling, he's leading the race right now. And Andrew Cuomo is polling beneath him. And I think Cuomo could still win, but in the general will be this fall, but really through some fuckery, to be honest. I think that he will win if an immense amount of money is poured into the race. If you know, every time you turn on the TV and there's like a huge get out the vote effort, I think Cuomo could win. But if you look at 2016, that's kind of what they did with the primary between Hillary and Bernie. And to be honest, arguably that hurt the party. Like Bernie, the people wanted Bernie and they subverted that. And I really feel like the people want Mamdani, and it's just, it's kind of where the people are.
That's not a good place for the people to be. Putting politics aside, yeah. And we haven't even talked about his politics.
Yeah.
You can agree or disagree with right. his views, his financial, economic
right.
plans.
Right. Which,
but this is a person who aligns with supporters of terrorism. This is a person who aligns with those who don't know if we should condemn murder or not.
Right, right. He has condemned both of, just, you know, to be fair to him, he has condemned both of those attacks. But obviously, I think more scrutiny is necessary to understand how he does feel about his relationship to the anti-Israel movement. Is he disturbed by how radical and uncompromising it has become? I'm also very curious, like, I would love to talk to him about October 7th. Like, does he feel like it's complicated? I don't know. I have heard him condemn it. I'm pretty sure, and that makes sense to me. I feel like he would condemn it, but I have interviewed his father, and his father feels like October 7th is complicated. Like, he condemns the violence, but told me that it was justifiable to describe October 7th as a military action.
So it's like someone condemning a murder, but like, oh, it's, no one should have died, but I don't know if we should call this a murder.
Yeah, I think it's like
condemning that a gun, that the trigger was pulled, but look, the gun was there for a reason.
I think it would kind of be like describing the Holocaust as a military action. Like a war against the Jewish people. Like, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think it would kind of be like that. So yeah, I have a lot of questions, but there was a poll that came out maybe a month ago showing that about 20% of Jewish New Yorkers support Zoe Rahn. So I've like met a lot of those supporters, and they released an ad recently where they're like, we're Jews for Zoe Rahn. Some people call us not real Jews, but we are. Anyway, they released an ad to kind of try and get ahead of this. And also because I think they think it's right. Like, those are Jews who do believe that there's a huge difference between anti-Zionism and anti, Semitism. Wait, I was like,
because there's so there's not a difference. You know, you keep making words. I mean, it's to me, it's the same argument as there are black for Trumps.
Yeah,
for Trump. That right. doesn't. There are black people who say racism does not exist. That doesn't make racism does not exist.
Right.
It just makes, you know, you as racist if you only listen, you tokenize the few that say that rather than the majority who don't say that.
I have been thinking about that comparison a lot, because it's also like the Naturi Carta. Is that how you say that?
the ultra-Orthodox sect.
Who are show up to like every within our lifetime rally. And so they're a very important optic for these anti-Israel activists. But the Black Trump voter is interesting because, yeah, in 2016, there was a lot of tokenism. But by like 2024, like a lot of Black people really are
right
for Trump. And so...
Right. I was referring to the 2016,
totally,
the tokenism
but
at
it
the
is,
beginning.
It is kind of... It's just something I think about like how it could evolve.
You know, before we end, you've had your ear to the ground on these issues, and again, the way you write about these issues, it makes it clear that this isn't just about Israel. This
right.
is about the U.S. This is about violence as a political action. Where do you think this movement is going to next?
I think it depends on if the lives of the people who are sucked into this get better. Like, I think, I don't know, maybe I'm naive for thinking this, but I feel like if some of these people like felt like their lives were fulfilling and like could afford a home, or maybe they wouldn't be so sucked into this. But like, you know, that's a tall
I'm pretty
order.
Sure,
you think it would still be happening?
I'm pretty sure many of these protesters at Harvard and Columbia and
so
Cornell,
true.
They not
so
only can
true.
They afford a home, they can, you know, they will get a home
right.
relatively soon.
Right. That's a really good point. That's a really good point. So yeah, I don't know that it's all like underscored by economic malaise. Where does it go? It's going to be interesting. I think it probably just will come to a head and perhaps fracture where, because I think already we're seeing this moment where there are people who are starting to realize, wait, like there's a very radical thread emerging here. And so I think that perhaps it will fracture where maybe there is a more moderate part of the movement that disavows the more radical part. But I don't know. It's also like a huge conundrum of how do you respond to this? Because I don't like one, you know, we talk as Jews, we talk so much about education, like the need for people to learn, but it's like, that sounds really bad. Like sending people to like re-education camps, like that's really bad. And so I have no idea how you undo this. I guess what I'm trying to say is like, it could either get better or a lot worse.
I think that's a great place to end because we really don't know.
We don't know.
We really don't know. So I'll keep following your
coverage, thanks.
And I hope many people will and the Free Press to see where things are going.
Thank you so much.
So we're going to end with what we call the Here I Am lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions. There's no right or wrong answer, just the first thing that comes to mind. Ready?
Yeah.
All right. So Olivia Rheingold, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Oh my gosh, I feel like I'm such an open book. Oh my gosh, why? Okay, I'm a horrible nail biter. Like literally, occasionally I have to visit urgent care because I'm like, I need antibiotics. Like it's becoming, I'm like, am I going to be 50 years old and have nubs for fingers? Like,
Well, with the anxiety that you take on, like the stress you take on, I don't blame you.
That's so true. It has gotten really bad when I've like been in those crowds.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
About the Jews. I think that there's a reason they call us a tribe.
What is your favorite curse?
Oh, like curse word?
Yeah. Or if you want to put a curse on
it's
someone.
It's got to be the F-bomb.
All right. Well, I mean, you've used it so many times, but now you call it the F-bomb.
Yeah, F-bomb.
When was the last time you cried?
It was this morning. It was this morning because, like, not to end on an overshare, but I recently got off of birth control because I did a MAHA story, if you know about MAHA, Make America Healthy Again. And it was like, they had a lot of good points, these ladies, about birth control and like, isn't it weird that we take it? It got to my head. I got off of it. And it has an unintended consequence of like, you can go through a shedding phase with your hair. And literally I have like 3 strands of hair, Shy. Like it's crazy. Every time I touch it, it's like falling out.
Just so people that are listening in should know that Olivia Rangold has a full head of hair.
No, you don't understand. I pulled it into a ponytail and like, cause I was trying to get
You're
ready
losing
for this.
All your credibility as a journalist now.
Trying to get ready for this podcast. And I was like, I called my mom and I was like, Mom, I don't know. I was like, why? I cried about my hair to my mom. Yeah. But before that, I went a long time without crying. Before that, I was like on a really good streak.
That's not, crying is not bad.
You're right.
Actually,
Thank you. That's why
I have this question here. To normalize crying. Men and women.
Love that.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
That would be my dad's dad. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but he died when my dad was like 12, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so I never met him. I don't know that much about him, but I really wish I did know more about him.
What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Passover.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm like with friends being funny, like we're laughing.
When do you feel least safe?
When people are yelling Zionist at me, but saying it with the vitriol of like dirty Jew.
What gives you hope?
Gen Z. I feel like Gen Z's head is kind of screwed on, right? I think the millennials, like, I don't know what is going on, but I think that there are a lot of members of Gen Z who really have their heads in the right place and believe in, you know, like, they don't feel like they need to be famous or have a fancy life to have a meaningful one. I feel like a lot of them are very family oriented and are sound and reasonable on Israel too, which is nice.
That's if true, then very hopeful.
Yeah.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
I guess I would. This is not very charitable of me, but I guess I would be selfish and say, ask like if you want to help support our reporting to become a subscriber to the Free Press.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
Olivia, where can people find you?
I am on Instagram. It should just be Olivia_Rheingold. I'm on X. I'm on TikTok. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Reddit. I'm everywhere. Just, you'll find me.
Olivia Rheingold.
Yes.
R-E-I-N-G-O-L-D.
Yep.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I know you have a flight to catch. So
yes.
Thank you so much for coming
you.
and doing this interview. And
yeah,
hopefully we
great.
Can follow up in a year and
yeah.
see the next year of interviews and articles. So here I am.
Here we are.
With Olivia Rheingold.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find